Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to Bottoming, the LGBTQ mental health podcast about rock bottoming and beyond. Kindly sponsored by Joe Malone London.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at BottomingPod or visit bottomingpodcast.com for more content relating to each episode.
We've also added a support page to the website to direct you to the right place if you're struggling or need someone to talk to.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Hello, I'm Matthew.
And I am Brendan, and our pronouns are he and him.
So we've got
a bog off deal today.
Whoa.
Buy one, get one bloody free. Both are free, what does that mean?
Yum.
It's a two-parter anyway.
It is a two-parter. You get two whole episodes this day.
Mm-hmm.
And not little skinny mini episodes either. You're getting
Juicy,
full-figured episodes.
Yeah.
If you are listening on day of release, it's 1st of December, which means it's World AIDS Day. So we wanted to get as many guests as we could do. So over the two episodes, we're going to be speaking to Callum, who is the author of a new report from the National AIDS Trust called HIV and Mental Health.
We're hearing from Jose, who is someone with lived experience of HIV and who walks us through his particular mental health journey.
And then we're going to be speaking to Andre from Positive East, who is
the counselling coordinator,
to share a bit more about
the process of seeking support,
what they do, just a little bit more. So hopefully you enjoy both of these episodes and you find them informative and useful.
I really enjoyed speaking to all of them, actually. Mm. It's a topic we touched upon during Pride Month for our last Pride Month episode. We spoke to Ash Kotak from AIDS Memory UK, and we spoke with Ron from the AIDS Memorial. So this now, kind of the flip side of it, is looking at the mental health aspect. Mm-hmm. So there's more of a focus on that for this episode or for these episodes. So we hope you enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Matthew, I know you've just got back from holiday.
I did.
Which I'm very jealous about. How have you been?
Yeah, I've been good. I've had an entire week off, which has been lovely.
Must be nice.
You wouldn't know it worked, David. Smacked you in the face. I've had a week off, and me and Sam went to Berlin for 5 days, which was really, really nice. I'm quite tired because it was a lot of walking, but it was really nice to get away. Mm. And I feel like we maybe were quite lucky in terms of getting away just before winter, COVID kicks off again. Yeah, it was nice. And I have a twitchy eye, actually. I don't know if I'm tired or stressed.
You're tired, but, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm fine. Hmm? I haven't been to counseling for 2 weeks because I've been
That's
busy,
convincing.
But yeah. It's just been a long year, hasn't it? And I can't believe that this episode is coming out on the first of December. So it just... How have you been?
I have been up and down because I've been kicked out of my house, which it's a lot of different emotions. It's a lot of different emotions that have come to the surface, because I've realised, you know, it's very, there's a whole theory about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm-hmm. It's like you need work, friendship, love, all of these different things. A safe place to live, mm-hmm, is one of those things. I had a safe place to live, now it's gone. Mm. So where do I go? Tell me, please, where do I go? I'm in the process of looking for somewhere new, mm-hmm, which is quite stressful, especially when you haven't made the decision to leave.
Yeah.
So,
just for clarity as well, you haven't been kicked out because you've done anything wrong. Let's just make that
thank
clear.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. Which I have asked the question, what have I done wrong?
Because if you tell people you've been kicked out, they're going to assume you've been very naughty.
Yeah. No, I'm a good tenant. Anyone listening? I'm very self-contained. I like to bake. I'll have a gab when people are around, but otherwise I keep myself to myself. So, mm-hmm, I mean, I've sold it for me. Don't know about for you. But yeah, that means I've been, yeah, just a bit all over the place. But, I'm wearing, I don't know if you can see on the camera, a badge which says prioritize pleasure, which I have been doing. But you gave it me because you want to see self-esteem.
I did. Well, to be fair, I'll just mention it now because there's also a lot of other things I'm going to talk about in the favourite thing of the week.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, I went to see Self-Esteem's gig in Heaven and fucking loved it because she put on one of the best shows I've seen in a lot of years. It was, mm-hmm, incredible. Yeah, and got you a little badge, didn't I?
Thank you so much.
Because what should we all do?
Prioritise pleasure.
In whatever form that takes for you. For you. For me. As we mentioned, it is World AIDS Day on the 1st of December. If you didn't know that, yeah, I don't know how you've missed it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, every 1st of December, since 1988, this has been the day that people have raised awareness. It is a time to mourn those that have been lost to the epidemic, but also a chance to celebrate as well the lives of those that are no longer with us. So one thing, kind of just a little during the background research that I came across, is a sentence that the UN have used quite regularly around this. And I think it plays into more than just HIV as well. I actually found this it was a UN article, kind of linking how we should learn from some of the things that we maybe experienced or saw during the HIV epidemic, and how we could also relate that to the COVID-19 pandemic as well. And the phrase they've used is, no one is safe unless we are all safe, which essentially just sums up why it's critical that we work on removing stigma around both, but in this, obviously in this context, we're talking HIV. So why the breakdown of stigma, discrimination is really, really important, because that in itself will then allow us to increase education, awareness and understanding, and obviously work towards a world where HIV is not a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of countries are working towards zero HIV new cases by, I think, 2030. And within the last couple of weeks, I know that there's been an announcement of a new drug that's been authorised in the UK. Mm-hmm. So now, instead of a daily pill to treat HIV, it can now be administered with one injection every couple of months, which obviously is an enormous, enormous milestone.
Yeah.
So fingers crossed over the next few years, we kind of see the progression just continue and hopefully even faster.
Yeah, lots more change. And as we mentioned at the beginning, we did do that episode at the end of Pride Month. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that episode, we talked about PrEP, how people use it and what's the need for it, etc., etc. So do refer to that if you require mm-hmm. any more information about it,
mm-hmm.
Because it's really useful.
Because treatment as prevention, U equals U, all of these different things, it all plays a part in everything we've just mentioned. So yeah, give that episode a listen.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get into it.
So our first guest is Callum from the National AIDS Trust, and he was the author of HIV and Mental Health, Improving Generic NHS Talking Therapy Services for People Living with HIV in England. So he basically talks to us about the key findings from that, the need for the research in the first place, and the potential implications of the research.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Callum.
Hi, I'm Callum. My pronouns are he, him. And I'm a policy and campaigns officer at National AIDS Trust, which is the UK's HIV rights charity. And I work across a number of policy areas, one of which is mental health as it relates to HIV.
So would you be able to tell us what led to the creation of this new piece of research, HIV and mental health?
Yeah, sure. So we know that people living with HIV are disproportionately affected by poor mental health. People living with HIV are twice as likely to experience feelings of depression or anxiety than the general population, and more than one in three report being diagnosed with a mental health condition at some time. Mm. And this is for a number of reasons. Despite major progress in treating and preventing HIV in a sort of medical sense, HIV remains highly stigmatized, and it also affects populations that are already marginalized, such as LGBT communities and people of color. Essentially, we have a good understanding of the relationship between HIV and mental health, but the support that's available to people living with HIV, the psychological support that's available, is inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
So traditionally, people living with HIV have been able to access support via their HIV clinic or through voluntary sector HIV support services.
Mm-hmm.
But these are not sort of universally provided across the country. And cuts to public health funding have seen the decommissioning of many voluntary sector services in recent years, which means that while some people living with HIV have access to specialist mental health support, others rely on generic services such as IAPT, which is a program, an NHS program, stands for Improving Access to Psychological Therapies. And these services provide short courses of talking therapy to people with common mental health needs such as depression and anxiety.
Mm.
But we and others in the sector were concerned that these services are not trained to or not trained in HIV specifically, or the specific mental health needs of people living with HIV. So our recent project set out to investigate the suitability of IAPT services for this community or this population,
mm-hmm.
And to develop recommendations to improve IAPT services for people living with HIV.
So you've mentioned already a kind of a couple of stats around mental health of people living with HIV, but was there anything kind of maybe that hadn't been spotted before they came out of the report? Any kind of key findings?
Yeah, so the stats that I mentioned before are sort of were things that we already knew. They were mm-hmm. sort of part of the rationale for us doing this research. Whereas this piece of work specifically was then looking at IAPT. Mm-hmm. And it found that while IAPT can work for some people living with HIV, issues such as a lack of HIV literacy and poor integration with wider HIV care are really hampering its effectiveness for many.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of sort of, I guess, the, some of the key findings of the report, we found that the most common problems experienced, or the most common problems that people sought help for through IAPT, were depression, general anxiety, and stress. But a significant proportion also reported panic disorder and PTSD, amongst other things. Mm-hmm. And 4 in 5 people reported that these were somewhat or directly related to living with HIV. So some of the ways that that might be related were stigma, whether that's kind of real experiences of being treated differently, or kind of fears of being treated differently, or fears of talking to other people about their HIV status, mm-hmm. The long-term challenges of living with HIV, difficulties maintaining sexual relationships, issues with medication, and so on. And we found that a lack of HIV awareness on the part of services is currently a real barrier to delivering appropriate support. So while I mentioned that 4/5 of respondents said that their mental health problems were related to living with HIV, mm-hmm. less than half described their therapist's understanding of HIV as good. Mm-hmm. And over a third did not feel that their therapist understood the ways in which HIV affects mental health. Mm. Perhaps most disappointingly, a quarter of people reported that they felt that their HIV status negatively affected the way that they were treated within IAPT. And unsurprisingly, this led to sort of unsatisfactory outcomes and a low sort of satisfaction with services. Mm-hmm. So we found that 2 in 5 respondents reported that their mental health did not change as a result of the therapy, while 1 in 10 reported that their mental health actually became worse. And over 3/4 of respondents reported that their experience could have been improved, while less than half said that they would be happy to use the same service again. I guess it's important to note that for some people, these services were working. We did have people who gave positive feedback, mm-hmm. but clearly there was a lot of room for improvement in order for IAPT to be able to, or for commissioners to be able to say that IAPT is a suitable service for people living with HIV and that it can be relied upon in the absence of more specialist services.
It's interesting that stigma is like such a huge part of this piece of research, and also collectively as LGBT people, I think there's a lot of stigma anyway, but around HIV and AIDS it's incredibly heightened. And although it's like a huge task to kind of approach, you know, the cultural stigma that is at play, I guess having the ability and the tools to adapt to that stigma and kind of look at it internally, it's incredibly necessary. So this research is incredible because it's kind of like looking at the point of help, I guess, to help people become more adaptable to the world.
Yeah, and I think that's often something that is particularly surprising or even shocking to people when we talk about HIV and HIV stigma is that the health service is not immune to stigma.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's often an assumption that, you know, while we all know that levels of understanding and attitudes towards HIV could certainly be improved in the general population, mm-hmm. there's, I think, often an assumption that, well, you know, at least healthcare workers will be well informed and this won't be an issue within the health system. And I'm certainly not, you know, intending to bash the health system. It's certainly much higher levels of HIV understanding, I'm sure, than in the general population. But we do know that people still have experience or sort of fear experiencing different treatment when they're accessing services, be they sort of from a GP or from an IAPT service. I think that in this report, we found that around 1/4 of people, yeah, as I said before, felt that they had been treated differently. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, simply not really acceptable.
And I think one thing to, I guess, say from our point of view as an LGBT mental health podcast, and it's something we kind of see repeated throughout kind of sexual health messaging as well. Like HIV doesn't discriminate in it. You know, for years it was viewed as a gay men's disease, and obviously that is completely untrue, which kind of leads to the next question of accessibility. You mentioned kind of,
you know, people may go to specialist services, which how did that come across in the research? Did you see that as maybe being more of a kind of like larger cities had better access to specialized services, which then led, say, people living in maybe smaller communities having to go to through the NHS rather than something that may be more specialized? Or was that not something that was found? Was that just a bit of a mixed bag?
It's certainly a postcode lottery. Mm-hmm. I don't know if our research, the data that we collected, as it didn't record geographical location of respondents, mm-hmm. we're unable to sort of say or to map out where exactly services are available mm. and where they aren't. But certainly from the research that we did in terms of the interviews we conducted with people living with HIV, but also with sort of mental health professionals, is that it is kind of commonly understood that services are more readily available, or HIV specialist services are more readily available in urban areas. Mm-hmm. But even within that, it's not kind of, I don't think it directly maps on necessarily. I think that it's often just an issue of funding. And that some areas that might traditionally have had access to HIV specialist support have seen funding kind of disappear as a result of sort of national cuts to public health budgets. Mm. And lots of people, particularly who relied on support from voluntary sector services, those services have often been, or many of those services have been decommissioned in recent years. Mm. So if you're not lucky, if you lived somewhere where you previously accessed support in that way, and you're not lucky you aren't lucky enough to have access to mental health professionals within your HIV clinic, which for many people may be based quite far away from where they actually live. Not everyone chooses to access their HIV care mm-hmm. in a nearby hospital, or they may not have the option of doing so, depending on where they live. So for those people, reliance on generic services is something that is a reality, and therefore generic services need to be equipped to support people with a range of needs, including those living with HIV.
And I guess that leads on to our final question in terms of money. It would be one of the main things that services need, but what else is it that we need to see?
So yeah, we developed sort of a range of recommendations that I guess can sort of be grouped into a few key areas. The first one is around sort of HIV awareness and HIV training. Mm-hmm. So we recommend that basic training on HIV and HIV stigma is added to the national IAPT curriculum. Mm. And this will help to tackle stigma within services and to ensure that wherever people living with HIV access IAPT, they can feel comfortable in doing so. And we also recommend that to better equip services to meet HIV-specific mental health needs, HIV pathways should be developed within the IAPT system. So just to sort of provide a bit of context, within the IAPT program, there are some services that are described as IAPT for long-term condition services or integrated IAPT services. And these have been developed basically in recognition across the health system of the benefits of receiving integrated care. So not having to sort of bounce around the system and mm-hmm. go to somewhere for your physical health and then somewhere else for your mental health and then somewhere for your HIV care. So it's about sort of providing more wraparound care. But those services so far haven't kind of considered HIV specifically, either in the training that those members of staff in those services receive, which do, for example, provide specific training on certain long-term conditions, but not currently HIV. And also in terms of the locations of those services. So sometimes those services might be embedded within physical healthcare pathways. So you might have an IAPT service or an IAPT worker who sits within a diabetes clinic. Mm-hmm. So we recommend that, that sort of model is looked at in relation to HIV. Mm. So you have sort of HIV pathways within the IAPT, the integrated IAPT program, mm-hmm. and relevant training that is added to the sort of that the curriculum for those integrated services. We also recommend that services, the IAPT services, are better connected to the wider physical and mental health care system to ensure that people living with HIV do not fall through cracks, basically, mm-hmm. in the system. So what that sort of means is that at the moment we heard from some people that they might have accessed IAPT and it might not have been, it might have been identified that that service wasn't really equipped to meet their needs. They might have had issues alongside mental health, for example, around drug and alcohol, but that there were not kind of clear pathways in place to ensure that someone was referred or sort of guided from one type of service that wasn't suitable to them into the right service for them. So then people kind of just fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. So we need to have IAPT services need to have clear pathways in place with other services, including HIV specialist services, to ensure that where people's needs are identified as not being IAPT appropriate, they aren't just kind of left then to fend for themselves, and instead are sort of supported into the right services for them. We also, and I think one of your previous questions touched upon this, need to ensure that IAPT services can more effectively meet the needs of the specific communities affected by HIV. So concerns about a lack of cultural competency and a lack of representation amongst kind of IAPT staff need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the kind of key themes that came up in a lot of the interviews that we did was that there was a frustration on the part of people living with HIV at having to explain to their therapist what it means to live with HIV, mm-hmm. where therapists didn't have a good understanding. So stigma is not necessarily often therapists might not have kind of actively stigmatizing attitudes towards HIV or ask inappropriate things, but just by not having an understanding of HIV, time that could be spent focusing mm-hmm. on the nitty-gritty of what people's issues are instead have to be spent yeah. on explaining to people or educating the therapist as to what HIV is and what it means to live with HIV. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, people then have to feel that they are having to explain what it means to be gay or to be trans or yeah. to be black in the UK today. So we have this kind of combined effect where people are having to explain to their therapists a kind of range of issues relating to their identity mm-hmm. before they can really receive help. So there needs to be much better training in place to ensure that the sort of intersectionality of mental health and HIV is better understood by the services that are providing support. So I think those are our kind of key recommendations. I think it's important to stress that people living with HIV in England are a really diverse community with a wide range of needs. Mm-hmm. And IAPT cannot be expected to meet all of those needs. And this report certainly does not set out to say that IAPT is a panacea or that it's kind of a fix-all solution to a problem. Rather, it must be as effective as possible mm-hmm. in meeting the needs of those people who meet its particular criteria for support. So IAPT should be part of a wider sort of mixed model of mental health provision, which includes HIV specialist services, which mm-hmm. includes voluntary sector HIV support services. But IAPT needs to ensure that its role within that system, it can perform as well as possible. Mm.
And so what happens, I guess, what's the next stage in terms of how this could actually be put into action? Is it just now up to policymakers and what they do with the research?
It's a good question. Essentially, I think that our recommendations are sort of divided into specific audiences. So we sort of make clear, as you know, who is responsible for making each of the changes that we are asking for. So the next steps for us is about engaging with those policymakers, and we're in the process of arranging conversations with IAPT itself and others to discuss and to work out how those recommendations can be implemented. And then it depends on not losing momentum or not kind of dropping the ball while attention is being focused on this as an issue. And obviously, as you mentioned at the very start, World AIDS Day is coming up, so there's increased discussion of HIV sort of amongst policymakers and amongst society, really. So we'll be working hard to continue advocating for these recommendations to be implemented.
So if you would like to find out a bit more about the research Callum has just discussed, you can go to nat.org.uk for researchers on there, as well as tons of other information and resources about the work that they do. So Thanks for chatting to us, Callum.
Thank you.
So next, we spoke to Jose. So National AIDS Trust put us in touch with Jose. Obviously, the focus of the report was around living with HIV and mental health and access to mental health services and what this experience was like. So it was such a fantastic chat, actually. I think both of us came away from it just, especially given that it is a mental health podcast, it was just really, really interesting to hear some of the things that Jose had to share with us. So again, thanks, Jose, for chatting with us and being so open. So here is Jose.
I'm Jose Mejia, and I use the pronouns he and him. And I'm here to talk a little bit about my sort of own personal experiences of living with HIV and the impact that has had on my mental health. I've sort of worked with a lot of other people living with HIV in the past, but today I'm going to just basically talk about my own experience.
So can you share a little bit more with us, I guess, about how you're doing generally, mental health-wise, just to kind of kickstart it off a little bit? And this episode is being released on World AIDS Day, so maybe tell us what World AIDS Day means to you.
Interesting. So first on how am I? First, happy to be here. So yeah, that's the first thing. And then in terms of in general, it's... Yeah, I think I'm doing well. I feel better than at many other times in my life. So it just feels really nice and stable at the minute. And I know it might not be like that for a while. And I'm now used to this sort of up and down on my own sort of mental health and but in general, I'm good. I'm healthy. I'm undetectable. I feel stable. I feel more resilient than I used to when I was younger. I'm quite amazed of how far I've come. Like, I'm surprised with myself, I guess. And I'm constantly sort of attentive to myself, to the signs within myself, if things are going better or worse, and I'm constantly searching for new things to do or new things to improve my well-being. Constantly on the search and constantly sort of riding the roller coaster, I guess. And in terms of World AIDS Day, that's a really interesting one for me, because I guess I've never been sort of a fan of these sort of special dates or things like that. One, because for me, it's World AIDS Day kind of every day throughout the year. But two, because I have a really bad memory, so I can never remember which date is which. And now it's like, there's dates for everything. So that's one thing. But in general, I really use this opportunity, or every 1st of December, I use the opportunity to it becomes like a really reflective day for myself, which sometimes can be very light and nice and positive. Some other times can be more like, really dense and hairy, and so yeah, it's been really a sort of long journey. But yeah, I use it as an opportunity to reflect on myself, on what's happening in the world, on HIV in general, rather than just my own experience. It's an opportunity for me to sort of remember all the things that have happened with HIV in general, with people who are not with us anymore, all the things that we're still not doing or not achieving and that we still need to do. Yeah, it's also an opportunity to celebrate, I guess. It's a really difficult word because we've lost so many people and we still do, and so it doesn't feel like a celebration, but I think I use the opportunity as well to as I can to celebrate, and I guess to celebrate that I'm still around and that I'm alive and that I have access to life-saving medication, and an opportunity as well to be very thoughtful, because Well, particularly thinking of people who might be struggling through World AIDS Day, because I guess I remember how difficult it was for me every 1st of December. I remember I got diagnosed probably in early November many years ago. That was like 2008, so I was quite young. It was just before World AIDS Day, and then I had World AIDS Day, and then that happened every year. And for a couple of years, it was just really difficult. Every World AIDS Day, I just didn't want to get out of bed. I didn't want to hear anything. I didn't want to put the TV on because there was all these things about HIV and AIDS, and I was like, I just couldn't handle it. I'm also thoughtful that it can be difficult for some people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think it's a mix of things, I guess, and it has changed for me. It used to be an awful day. I used to hate it. Mm-hmm. Now I'm much more light and reflective about it, I guess.
Mm. I mean, thinking about like the report that the National AIDS Trust produced, obviously we spoke to Callum about the findings of that. One of the main things within that is the feeling of stigma around HIV and AIDS, and it's obviously very apparent. What role does that play in your day to day?
I always talked about HIV like this journey, partly because I've gone a long way, but I know I'm still not. I know I'm gonna go somewhere else, and I always talked about this idea of like a roller coaster, because that's how it feels. You know, it's like some days, the first few years were awful. Then for a couple of years, it was great. And now it's like a more of a day-to-day thing. I have some days that are great. I have some days that are not. And that relates to what you're asking. And it relates a lot to things like stigma and discrimination and to things happening in the media and the news and in other parts of the world. So I think just to go sort of in parts, I think with stigma and discrimination, I mean, I've been lucky, and when I say I've been lucky, I've had a support network around me, and it's been on stages. So when I was first diagnosed, I was accessing therapy actually, and that he was the person who helped me navigate the whole thing, helped me navigate the health system, how to find what I needed, the support that I needed, the medications that I needed, etc. Because I was just so lost and confused. Then that extended to sort of my family, so my dad, my mom, my sister, and that came with very difficult conversations and ones in which I felt judged and stigmatized and sort of not understood or whatever. Thankfully, that changed, and they've stayed with me and they've supported me throughout the whole process. Then I had a group of friends who were there when I was at my darkest, and they were the ones saying like, come on, come with us, go here, meet us here, let's do this, this will be good for you, let's just get out of your house, blah, blah, blah. And I'm really thankful for that. I've had that support system, but with that have come like the people you don't know and still get to have a saying on your life. So whether that is through Grindr or dating apps or to your face, guys you're dating or people you meet, or your sort of extended family members. And so there's a lot of that. There's been a lot of Grindr things. There's a lot out there about how difficult navigating Grindr can be, and particularly for someone living with HIV, mm-hmm. and I guess I have all the things that make it even harder. I'm brown and I'm a migrant, and so there's all these things that sort of intersect in my experience of things like Grindr, but HIV stigma has been awful, and I'm saying this, and yeah, I'm not on Grindr now because I'm in a relationship, but until very recently, you know, like 2020, and I get people telling me, yeah, what I should have done and what I shouldn't have done and how to behave, and it's like, wait a minute, this just isn't right. Thankfully, some of that have come with people doing their own process, and I think I tried not to take it very personally, because otherwise I wouldn't be here. I would just be devastated and crying, and I wouldn't get out of bed. So I just, yeah, at some point I understood that a lot of this wasn't my issue, it was them's. So I removed myself from the whole situation, but it is awful, and it still has an impact on my day to day. The other scenarios have been navigating, well, the other thing I was talking about, so is the news and the media and what happens in other parts of the world. I think I still struggle to reflect on my privilege as someone living with HIV. So the fact that I have access to medication, the fact that I live in the UK and I have access to a great sort of health system and a great clinical and social care. So I'm very lucky, but that doesn't mean, I still know that that's not the case for everyone, and that still makes me really upset. You know, that's one of the things that still affects my day to day and my well-being a lot. Just knowing that people in other parts of the world and have no access to medication and are still dying, or that people here with the amazing care that we have are still not able to engage for a number of different reasons. And lastly, there's something about the day to day around sort of navigating systems, for the lack of a better word, but the healthcare system and the academic system and a lot of things, and every time I have to do something like that, I have to face this thing about like disclosing my HIV status and putting it in forms and in papers and how that makes me feel, and I used to struggle a lot with that, and now it's easier, and now I live very openly with HIV, so now it's very hard for all these things to affect me, but it's still a constant reminder, a day-to-day reminder of what is happening or what isn't happening in my life, and how I relate to the HIV movement more broadly, I guess.
And going to the core of the research, and you touched on your experiences with your therapist initially and how he was quite supportive. Would you be able to talk us through that experience with the mental health services, and just share as much or as little as you like with that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's been quite an interesting one for me, because I only moved to the UK in 2015. So part of my experience was based back home in Colombia, and part of my experience has been based here in the UK. But that just shows you how long of a journey it's been, you know. I've been accessing mental health services for over 10 years, probably. So I was initially diagnosed in 2008. Then I was seeing a therapist for a number of other reasons. And then when the diagnosis happened, I got just to such a low point. I was just in such a dark space, and yeah, I just wanted to die, and I was just not ready to yeah, I wasn't ready for all of this. And I guess he was a psychiatrist, and so he was very aware and very in touch. He helped me through the whole process of navigating the system, finding what I need. But then he also sort of suggested that I went into taking antidepressants, which I tried. I tried a couple of them. I hated them. I just couldn't. I couldn't function. I couldn't work. And I'm saying this very cautiously, because I know they work for a lot of people. So I don't want anyone to think that they don't work. They do work for a lot of people. They just didn't feel right for me and what I was going through. So I tried them. They didn't really work. So we sort of slowly stopped. We tried different dosing, et cetera. But yeah. Then through my clinical care and the diagnosis, what was available at that time back. But then in Colombia was, basically like an occupational therapist that you were able to see. I was just not ready to engage. So I was like, no, I don't want anything else to do with this clinic. Like, I just need my meds and that's it. Thank God, like, the two doctors were gay men, or the two doctors I saw at first were gay men. So that was really helpful as well, because there was that sort of relatability and me not feeling judged, et cetera. And then when I moved to the UK, I sort of, just didn't know what was available, didn't know what I was entitled to as someone who isn't born here. So I started looking into it. I got my clinical care that was all sorted very easily with support from my university, etc. Then I started realizing that there were things in my life again that didn't feel right, that I was in a better place with my HIV, but that a lot of things in my life weren't where I wanted to be and that I needed someone that I could talk about these things. And I started looking. I reiterated a lot about looking and looking because that's what it feels like. You know, it feels that you need to be like really driven and really determined to find what you need. Mm-hmm. First, to understand that you need it, which is already very difficult, and then to take the steps to access it, which is another story, and it's another story that is also very difficult. So I thankfully, I've been very pushy and determined. So I was like, okay, no, I need to talk to someone. This can't just be me just pretending that nothing's happening. So I started looking. I was living in Lambeth back then. And so I managed to find a service that was culturally competent, let's say. So a service that, it was a counseling service in Lambeth who had therapists in different languages, which was great because I managed to access therapy in Spanish. So it made it way easier for me to express myself, to talk to someone, etc. Yeah, and then that stopped because, of course, it's short-term. You're meant to see someone for a number of sessions, whether you are better or not. That's fine. That's what we have. So I saw someone for a number of sessions. It was very helpful. It came to a period of my time in which I was going through sort of a breakup and a lot of drama as well. So that was very helpful. And then again, at some other point, I thought something doesn't feel quite right, and I need to talk to someone again, and I need more support again, and that comes with its own impact, you know. It's like, oh God, I just got this, and it worked, and now I'm feeling like this again. So then the shame and the blame and the guilt for like, why am I not okay? Why is not all of this sort of making me just feel great and perfect? And of course, I know that's not how it works, and I know that's ups and downs, and I've come to sort of slowly accept that. So when again I felt that I needed something, I started looking. There were less and less options available. I've already tapped in the one that was most prominent or visible. So then I was like, there's probably not gonna be anything that there's not gonna be anything that I can access anymore. And that was really saddening and frustrating. And then finally I find that through the HIV clinic I could access something that was again CBT. And I think at different points I thought like, or before accessing all these services, I thought like, is this a good idea? Do I really, it's an IAP service really gonna help me? It's a CBT kind of therapy gonna help me? But I think I've been very open to try them, you know. It's like, I am just gonna give it a go, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but maybe something will happen and maybe it will work. Because you also hear that from a lot of people. It's like, no, I don't want CBT is not good for me, which it's great that they know. For me, it's been more of like, I don't know, I need to try. So that's what I've done with the HIV clinic. I think the challenging bit was that there was this idea of, oh, is it HIV related? So the reason why you're going to access the therapy, it needs to be HIV related. And for me, it was like, wait a minute, what does that even mean? It's like, so somehow everything in my life happens to be HIV related, you know? Yes, I'm living well with HIV, and I lived openly with HIV, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't had an impact on my life and how I live the rest of my life and how I make decisions and things like that. So it was just very shocking to see that, like, yeah, somehow it was limited and I needed to have a reason related to HIV, when in my life, well, or at least in my understanding, everything seems to be related to HIV. And because again, that's not for a lot of people. If a lot of people are faced with that question, they might say, oh no, my HIV is fine, and then don't get what they need. So I think it's important that the system or that mental health services give people the opportunity to explore those links. That's precisely the reason why some of us need to go to therapy, because we need to understand how our HIV relates to the way we lived our relationships, or how our HIV relates to our isolation, and so all these things. But that's what I mean, that it feels to me like a very cruel system, because you need to be very thorough and very clear and very determined to get what you need. And if you're having a lot of mental health problems, that's a lot of the things that you're not, or that's how you're not feeling, at least. So it's really hard to navigate and to find and to access. But I think I've sort of somehow been lucky, really, and have had what I need. Thank God, because of other decisions in my life, it hasn't escalated to me needing any other form of mental mm-hmm. health care. It's only been sort of primary care, and it's always been contained in that part of the health system.
And so what's led you to want to talk publicly about your experience?
I mean, it's interesting. I think I initially didn't know I wanted to talk publicly about my experience, or that I was willing to talk publicly about my experience. When I was first diagnosed in 2008, I remember telling one of those first doctors, like, I wish I could do something with this. I wish I could use my skills mm-hmm. with this. But I was a mess. I just couldn't look up. I just couldn't get out of bed. So one of the things he said then was, just park that thought, you know, hold that thought, stick to it. Mm-hmm. It might happen. Maybe it's just not the right time, but stick to that. And I was like, yeah, great. I completely forgot about that. I live my life. I party, I loved, I did, I didn't, etc. And then, when I moved here, back in 2015, I was sort of studying and working at the same time, but I still felt that I had some free time and that I wasn't using that free time appropriately. I started engaging in things, well, to be more specific, engaging in sex and in chemsex, and thinking, like, at some point, like, ooh, this can be too much, and I need to sort of remove myself a little bit. And the easiest way to do that is to keep myself busy. Not that keeping yourself busy that could also have an impact on your emotional health. Yeah. But I thought, okay, I need to get busy to move away from this. And from a conversation with a cousin, he said, like, oh, have you ever thought of volunteering? And I was like, okay, yeah, maybe. And I started looking into it, and I just thought, like, okay, which are the things I care of? And I made a list, and there was a lot of things, and I tried, like, animal rights and environmental stuff and, like, a lot of things. Nothing really happened, nothing really came true, and nothing really made me be the determined person I was. And then HIV, partly being on Grindr, I saw a message when Grindr was more accessible for charities, I guess, and I saw a message, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. This seems to be, like, for me. They're looking for someone who speaks Spanish, who wants to talk and learn about HIV. This seems like a good fit. So, yeah, I just got in touch with an HIV charity back in 2016. I started volunteering with them and did that for a year. Initially, it felt like... as I was saying, it didn't feel like I needed to talk about myself. I just went. I knew I needed to learn more about HIV. Mm-hmm. I knew that was going to be important. I didn't know much. I have sort of, through the first 8 years of my diagnosis, blocked myself around it. I just knew I needed to take my medication, be okay with it. But I just didn't want to know anything else. I just blocked myself. So when I came here, it was like, okay, I do really need to learn more and to understand this better. Because that will give me tools and that will give me better ways to handle the whole situation. And I had that feeling of, I want to give back as well. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for some people, and I want to give back. So then I volunteered with the charity for a year. Initially, it felt like, I talked about my HIV, but it was very discreetly and very quietly in a room with just a number of other people living with HIV. So I feel very safe. I felt very... like, I still was protected and still no one needed to know, but I was still talking about it, and I was starting to see the benefits of talking about it. Then after volunteering for a year, and I applied to a role, and then I sort of moved within the organization. And by moving within the organization, I started meeting more and more people living with HIV who were living openly with their HIV. Mm. And it was just very inspiring, you know, and it was just very just seeing their openness and how free they were and how light it all felt when they talked about it. I was like, wow, I want to feel like that. I want to be like that. And yeah, and it was particular. I remember meeting a lot of women and women talking openly about their HIV, and I was like, this is amazing. Yeah. And then there was a lot of reflection of what's stopping me. What is it that is not letting me take that step up, that step and be more open about my whole situation and my journey? And yeah, and then slowly it started to happen, I guess, organically. It's hard to tell when it was and it's hard to tell. But then, yeah, there were projects in the charity and campaigns, and we're doing this campaign. If anyone living with HIV want to talk about it? And I was like, okay, I can. And yeah, and it slowly happened. And now I see my face in more and more places and my voice in more and more places, which wasn't what I was planning. And which still, it still can be difficult. And yeah, so I don't know. I think I just didn't know I wanted. And now, once I've done it, once I've had that feeling of, oof, that freedomness and that lightness of having talked about it and not giving a shit. And I think it was partly that. At some point, I realized that no matter what I do or what I don't do, people are still going to have a say in my life or are going to think that they're entitled to have a say. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not going to give a shit about them. I'm just going to do what I need to do and get on with my life in the best possible way. And I realized that talking and learning about HIV was just life-changing for me. You know, it just gave me so many things. And yeah, so much confidence and so much self-worth and a lot of the things that I've lost throughout the whole journey. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I did that. And I think through that process, you start seeing a lot of sort of angles to talking about HIV and talking about dealing with HIV. So then it become talking about access to medications in other parts of the world, and it become about like barriers that migrants face in the UK to access services, and then it become about mental health of people living with HIV. And then it become about like underrepresentation of migrants and trans and black and brown people and women, especially women in HIV research. So yeah, it has grown onto moving me into a lot of other areas of work that I've just never thought they were possible. And yeah, and it just made me very passionate. Like I've never seen myself as an activist, but I guess now that's like the easiest way. Now that I don't work in the sector because I moved to do something else, yeah, the best way to refer to myself is I do HIV activism from time to time, and I live openly with HIV, and that's a way of activism where you have opportunities or platforms like this to talk about it, or where you don't. Just I think living openly with HIV is such a revolutionary act that's just a massive way of doing activism where you have a platform or not. So yeah,
that progression from like, as you described, being so low and then going through this whole journey and landing in a place where you're able to talk empoweredly about it. I don't know if that's the right word.
Empoweredly?
In an empowered way about your experiences. It's just incredible that you've done that. To kind of finish us off, what advice would you give to someone who is at that starting phase and not really sure where to go with the mental health route?
Interesting. I mean, the first thing is I wouldn't want to tell anyone to not feel the way they're feeling. So feel the way you're feeling, feel like shit, feel angry, feel annoyed, feel disappointed, feel all these things. Yeah, just allowing yourself to feel that way can or cannot, so be very conscious of that, help you move forward. But I think first, yeah, embrace those feelings and slowly deal with them. Trust sort of your gut feeling and your intuition with, like, there's always this thing, or at least within most of us, that tells you it is going to be okay. Things are going to be okay. So trust that, and then take steps that you think might help you with your own well-being and take them as quick or as low as you need to. So pace them accordingly to your needs and to your possibilities. Find someone that you can talk about it, even if it's just one person, but find someone that you can talk about it, because that will make a massive difference. hopefully and ideally find someone who lives with HIV that you can talk about it, because that will change your life, just seeing someone else's perspective. And sort of slowly learn to recognize that, like, yeah, embrace the fact that it is going to be a journey, that it is going to have ups and downs. And I think learn to recognize the signs on yourself, the signs of things getting better or the signs of things getting worse, and sort of, yeah, understand them and harness them and just grip them and find your way through them. And then, yeah, become a really good navigator of the system, because it isn't easy. Services aren't just going to come to you knocking to your door. You have to go knocking yourself. So yeah.
Thanks again to Callum and Jose for this episode. You've really brought some really interesting perspectives and insight into the lived experience of people with HIV. So we're really, really grateful for that. And that brings us to the end of part one of this episode. Join us for part two, where we speak with Andre from Positive East and hopefully a few special voice notes from the Red Run that they host. We say hopefully because we're recording this on a Friday and it's on the Saturday. So. All manner of things could go wrong. But here's hoping.
So thanks. Head over to part two of this episode right now. Ideally, you know, you can listen to all in one. Get your fix straight away, or, you know, listen to it whenever. But...
And we'll also be having our positive thing of the week over on that episode. Mm-hmm. So.
Which I know you're all gagging for.
Gagging
so
for
you
it.
Simply have to keep listening.
Okay.
We'll see you. See you in a bit.
You're doing amazing, sweetie.
Bye for now.
Mwah.
Would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.